All right, welcome to the pastor's class. This is session four, which I'm calling Christ Our Life, a 10-week course on the Christian faith. Today we're looking at the topic world religions and Jesus Christ. Is he the only way? Now, there are all kinds of ways we could approach this. So certainly it doesn't really need to be said, but I think it should be said that there isn't anything particularly exhaustive about the way I'm going about it. I'm just trying to touch on what I think are some of the important issues related to each of these topics and to give you some ammunition and something to think about and perhaps others to think about you may speak with. The uniqueness of Christ from the very beginning of the church's life has been the issue, capital T. The claims of the New Testament regarding Jesus simply don't leave any room to put him on the shelf with, you know, Euclid and Plato and Pythagoras and Aristotle as just one more great thinker who came along, and now you can add his book to the library. The New Testament simply will not let you do that. It doesn't mean that people haven't done it and aren't doing it, but it is not consistent with the New Testament witness at all. And I wanted to read something. This is a quote from C.S. Lewis. It's from a book called The Case for Christianity. This is what he writes on this score. I'm going to read it. It's not too long, but I think it's worth hearing. The popular British writer C.S. Lewis has addressed one of his books, Case of Christianity, to this issue. His purpose, he says, is to prevent anyone from saying the really silly thing that people often say about him, about Jesus, which is, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. With all the delicacy of a battering ram, Lewis continues. This is C.S. Lewis. That's the one thing we mustn't say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said wouldn't be a great moral teacher. He'd either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he'd be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But don't let us come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He hasn't left that open to us. He didn't intend to. That is the issue. Now, some have said, well, the original Jesus of the New Testament didn't make any of those claims that the New Testament writers put in his mouth about he and the Father and that he's the Messiah and so forth. That was all done later by other people, you see. That's one of the arguments you will hear and has been put forward, to which, you know, you simply say, how do you know? What we know is what the New Testament reports. To try to get behind it and to say, well, that these things were made up, these things were testimony and the witness of several centuries of the Christian church didn't seem to feel the need to debunk any of this. And they certainly knew more than we do about the events and what happened. So that argument is just trying to support itself in terms of denying these things. And I think Lewis is right that on the surface of the New Testament's witness, you simply cannot accept Jesus as another great philosopher or teacher. There is no room for that in the New Testament witness. You may not agree with what Jesus says about himself. You may not like it, we could say, but that doesn't change it any. And the early Christians certainly knew enough about him, were with him enough, to know whether or not the witness of the Gospels, for example, was completely out of line, you know, or if they are faithful and accurate representations of the experience people had with Jesus. And that certainly has been the testimony and the witness of the church from the very beginning. Now, as we look at the question, I put a text up here from Matthew 11, which kind of exemplifies this, where Jesus says, all things have been delivered to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father. No one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Now, there are a number of other places, of course, in the New Testament where the relationship of the Father and the Son is laid out like this in very intimate terms. But this is a good example where Jesus is talking about his intimate relationship with the Father. It is unique. It's irreplaceable. No one else can claim it. It's his only. And that relationship, that knowledge of the Father, is available only to those to whom he chooses to give it. Really an offense on a number of levels, you see. But this is what Matthew tells us. Now, two of the big words here we want to look at to start this morning are religion and revelation. Or as I say, religion or revelation. We're not talking about the book of Revelation, we're talking about revealed truth, revealed knowledge. And the two subcategories are religion and the radical generosity of human reason, religion and the radical exclusivity of the incarnation. And here is where the two ships collide. This is where the two plates, tectonic plates, come together. In the classic arrangement of the scenario here, religion we define historically as man's attempt to find God. It begins within the self. There is a kind of vague urge, desire, intuition, inquisitiveness to discover something divine, something about the divine, you get the picture. Then historically, the way we've talked about world religions is to say that this is what world religions are the product of human endeavors from within the self to construct a fabric of meaning based on our self-perceived understanding of God or gods. Okay, so if you take the ancient world, for example, the ancient Egyptians, they're living along the Nile Valley for many, many thousands of years, of course, as it is today, but in the early, early millennia, way, way back, they have almost zero scientific knowledge of the world, you know, any objective view of reality, we might say. And so they look at crocodiles and birds and hippopotami and the sun and the moon and the stars and the Nile River itself and various other aspects of the natural world. And because there is power and life and energy in these things, they within themselves assume that somehow these things are all part of greater powers, of higher powers. And so when the Egyptians, for example, worshiped the crocodile, which they didn't believe that the crocodile was God, a god. They believed that there was a kind of godness, a crocodile godness in crocodiles. In other words, that aspect of the great divine that was sort of crocodilian was in crocodiles. And so they worshiped that aspect of the greater divine universe, you see. So that this is what idolatry was, and it was worshiping the things that we would say have been made for their attributes and not the maker. Now, the closest that the Egyptians ever got, the ancient Egyptians ever got, to moving beyond this was in the late Bronze Age, in the 14th century BC, when the famous or infamous Pharaoh Akhenaten tossed out the entire pantheon of the Egyptian gods except the sun. And the sun in its solar manifestation, because there's always more behind what you see. And it was the disk of the sun that Akhenaten worshipped. And that the solar disk, then, he claimed, was the source of life. All life came from the sun, the solar disk, the Aten. So when you see it depicted from his reign, you'll see pictures of the sun. They have rays coming down with a hand at the end, extending life. That's as close as the Egyptians ever got to what we might call monotheism. Well, it really wasn't a monotheism, because at the end of the day, Akhenaten really thought he was the incarnation of the solar disk. So it all got kind of funny. But the point being that religion begins with us. We create religion. And so religion can be expected to be a reflection of who we are. Now, before we get too far along this path, we want to be clear about what that means then, for example, for Christian faith. Christianity, insofar as it goes, can be for people nothing more than a religion. Exemplified, for example, in statements like, well, I go to church for what I can get out of it. Now, that really is no different than the Unitarian, than the Zoroastrian, anybody else of that ilk saying, religion all really comes down to what I think about it, how I assess it, what I say it does for me, what good it does for me. And insofar as we practice that way of thinking, we are nothing more than religionists. That's all we are. We're just religionists. You know, it's not much different than having the hobby of consuming ice cream. And you make a fine study of going to Baskin-Robbins and examining very carefully the various barrels of flavors and finally deciding based on your own appetites and your own taste which one or which ones you choose to take. That's what religion is. It is driven by our own intellectual appetites, our own perceptions. This is a very simplistic way of talking about it, but you get the point, okay? So there are a lot of benefits to dealing with the divine in this way. What are some of the benefits in dealing with the divine like this? The issue of the divine. Okay, since you've defined what the divine is supposed to give you, if you feel like you're getting it, then you've got some reward, or at least you've got some satisfaction. So what's some other benefits of this?
You can pick and choose.
Yeah. Like Burger King or Baskin-Robbins.
You don't have to change.
You don't have to change? Matter of fact, it's probably a good idea that you not change because you want to be comfortable within yourself, right? Okay, so you don't have to change. Anything else? Okay, well, you get the picture then. I think you can see what we're talking about. So religion as an expression of the generosity then of human reason is very, very popular. The Romans, in their time, you know, world conquerors, right? No stone left unturned, no country unconquered, if they had anything to say about it, were extraordinarily generous when it came to religions. The Romans had no desire to eliminate the religions of other peoples. They were very content to let those peoples practice their religions as long as they added the worship of the Roman emperor, the cult of the emperor, to their pantheon. Everything was fine. And everyone in the empire did that except the Jews. The Jews were the only ancient people that the Romans conquered that would not worship the emperor. Everybody else did, and everybody else kept their religions, and they got along famously because the Romans were pragmatic. They were very much influenced by Greek philosophy and Greek thinking, very, very rational kind of people. Had a very violent side, but that wasn't what affected this. They had a very rational side, and they were probably the exemplars of this in the ancient world, that religion is an extension, finally, of the generous diversity of human experience. We might say it that way. Most educated Romans were very uncertain about whether they even were gods. You know, they weren't walking around like a bunch of mindless idiots. They were really unsure. A lot of things didn't add up. But the worship of the gods in the ancient world, in the Roman world, was part of the fabric of life. So even if you didn't believe it, you did it. You know, remember that famous expression when it came to the historic episcopacy years ago when we were fighting that fight? And one of the theologians who was advocating us adopting the episcopal office says, you don't have to believe it, just do it. You don't have to believe they have the power to ordain people or to make the sacrament. Just act like you do, you see. And that's how a lot of the Romans in the ancient world and probably among other ancient cultures functioned as well.
They're gods.
They're gods, yeah. You know, I mean, you live in the world long enough and you realize there's no logical connection A to B between praying and getting what you want. I mean, there's a lot of things happening in between that make you wonder, are there really any gods up there? When they excavated Santorini, where the great volcano exploded, you know, some people think that was where Atlantis was located. The myth of Atlantis came from there. There's a big caldera there now underwater, but originally the city was there and the harbor was there. And then it all blew up. When they excavated there back in the 60s, they found the fallen down stone structure of a small temple, the remains of a young girl who'd been holding some kind of a bowl or a vase, the remains of a young man whose wrists were bound behind his back, and the remains of an old man who had a knife in his hand. And what they surmised was that as the earthquake became more serious, they rushed this young man up into this temple to sacrifice him to the gods, to stop the earthquake. So religion draws these kinds of conclusions, see? And one of the most basic ones in the ancient world was life for life. If we're going to get life, we have to give it. This is behind the whole sacrificial system of ancient cultures. In order for us to receive life from the gods, we've got to give some life back to the gods. So the Aztecs are probably the most famous for this. How much blood they shed is probably beyond calculating. And it was all to give life back to the gods. And they just couldn't stop. You know, it kind of became their way of doing things. So this is the point. Religion and the radical generosity of human reason are a good marriage. And in our time, post-Enlightenment, this view of religion has taken on a new strength and vigor. If you're going to make any room for religion at all, I mean, and any rational, scientifically minded person in the 21st century knows that religion is really just a human construct. But if you're going to have to go there, then at least be generous and allow everybody else to go there in the way they want to go there. And that's the culture we live in. See? The point is, this is no longer a Western society that assumes revealed truth. This is a society that assumes discovered truth. That's what happened when the thinking of the Enlightenment took hold in Western Europe. Now, truth is no longer revealed from heaven. Truth is revealed through scientific and reasoned discovery and research and effort. That's the world we're in. And that's why there is such disdain and indifference widely toward religion. Because religion belongs to an antiquated past when people didn't know any better, didn't understand how the universe works, they were scared of their own shadows. Every time something bad happened, they thought it was their fault, they blamed the gods, or you know, they were being punished, like I said in my sermon. That world is gone. Now we're in an enlightened world, a rational world. This religion stuff is simply a byproduct, a holdover from a pre-enlightened age. You know, in order to understand the problem of confessing Christ in the way we do as the unique revelation of God, we have to realize that we are speaking language that the culture no longer recognizes as even valid. I can remember 35 years ago in the seminary, certain professors talking about how the day of revealed religion is over. I didn't quite grasp it at the time the way I probably should have, what these guys were talking about. But now I totally understand what they were saying. Now, compare and contrast that with religion and the radical exclusivity of the incarnation. St. Paul verse. God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself. Well, that's either true or it isn't. I mean, and that's a statement that absolutely assumes truth is revealed from outside of the norms of rationality. In other words, it originates beyond us. God was in Christ, in the man Jesus, reconciling the world, bringing the world back to himself. The entire exclusive witness of the New Testament to the uniqueness of Jesus was a great offense to the Roman world.
for reasons we've already talked about here. And that's why for a long time, the Romans couldn't distinguish between the Jews and the Christians, because they both represented the same problem. It was the exclusivity of their faith that was so deeply offensive to the Romans. And for a while, they just lumped the Christians in with the Jews. And it's a Jewish cult, you see. And they thought, well, they're talking about the same God, but now they talk about this God as this Jesus guy somehow. And they didn't quite get how it was all tied up. It was just confusing to them, you see. In fact, the earliest pictographic image of Christ is in one of the prisons in Rome. It's a picture of a donkey, of an ass, nailed to a cross, and beneath it, it says, Alexamenos worships his God. So they assumed that there was probably a Christian kept there in prison, and the prisoners saw him. Maybe he made a cross of some kind and was worshiping in jail, and so the guards, to make fun of him, carved this donkey on a cross and said, Alexamenos worships his God. See, the Romans just couldn't get it. You know, it's foolishness and nonsense, you see. But the point where it's relevant for us today is, where these realities intersect, is that it's the same exclusivity of the witness that offended the Romans that offends the post-Enlightenment culture of modern 21st century Western minds. See, the generosity of human reason must be extended to everything, including how we define the divine. Because ultimately, the divine is a matter of personal interpretation and personal belief. Now, there's no solution to this. We should be clear about that. This is not a problem to be solved. It is a reality to be confronted and contended with. But there is no way to bring these parties together. This is what the Universalists and the Unitarian movements have tried to do by simply saying, well, we'll just deny the divine stuff about Jesus and make him a teacher. Then he no longer offends anybody, and as I said earlier, you can just put his book on your shelf. You got the Euclid book, the Pythagoras book, the Plato book, the Aristotle book, and there's the Jesus book. Wise man, lots of good teachings. There's plenty there for you to read and learn about and, you know, give you good tips for daily living and all the rest of it. But there's no extra revealed word from the Creator uniquely present in the man Jesus. These two views are irreconcilable, okay? Either religion is a product of human imagination, fear and longing, which is what Freud said, and Christianity is just one more of those religions, or religion is a product of human fear and longing, but Christianity is God's word to human beings trapped in their fear and longing. Now, the church, for its long history, has struggled with this. The first era, and probably the greatest era of struggle, seconded only by our time, was the time of the great creeds, the great creedal councils. And what was the single most important issue that the creedal theologians and bishops and lay people, for that matter, over those couple of centuries, what did they fight over and struggle over more than anything else? Who is Jesus? Only a man? Only a God appearing as a man? Part God, part man? No God, all man? And it was a couple hundred years of great struggle. I mean, think about that. The church struggled with the identity of Jesus almost as long as this country has been here, trying to hammer out a concise meaning. And so finally, in the great Nicene Creed, which really is the great creed of the church, they finally came up with the language, true God and true man, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father. They came to understand that unless we hold to this confession, which the New Testament has given us, the entire Christian faith collapses
into a world religion. The early fathers understood this, that to be faithful to the witness of the New Testament and to their own experience as faithful people who had been encountered by the Spirit and the Word, to be faithful to that, the only way they could do so was to maintain the exclusive witness of the unique revelation of God in Jesus of Nazareth. There was simply no other avenue to take. And so they fought off, you know, well over a dozen Christological groups that were vying for some combination of God-man language where Jesus is concerned that emptied him of both his full divinity and his full humanity. There was there's too many to list. There were all kinds of Christological groups that were trying to make Jesus palatable to some dimension of reason or to somebody's religious inclination. And it was the great genius, and we would say as Orthodox Christians, the great gift of the Spirit to that hard work of the church over those centuries, that the church was able to hold the line against these temptations and to say, Jesus was true God and true man of one being with the Father. And the reason for that was so that when we see what Jesus did and said for us, we can have absolute confidence that it is true for us. For us and for our salvation, the Creed says, he came down from heaven. And that's why that's in there. For us, you see. You can believe that the one who was born and suffered and crucified, died and buried, raised, it was done for us because the living God did it. So that's what was at stake for them. Now, moving on to the next big section here of the three we're going to look at this morning. And like I said earlier, we could go all kinds of places, but we're just going to stay with a kind of a small outline.